Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. Scientists report that a 1.5 degree Celsius rise in the Pacific Ocean water is entering the Arctic Ocean. A Hong Kong company has stopped all operations at 2 of its ports on the Panama Canal. The leaders of China and Germany pledged to strengthen economic ties and free trade. NHK Japan.
A team of scientists says a rise in Pacific Ocean seawater temperatures has been accelerating the decrease of ice in the Arctic Ocean. It says temperatures rose about 1.5 degrees Celsius from 2000 to 2019. The team at the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology and a Canadian research institute have published a report on its long-term observations of seawater flows. They installed devices on the seabed north of Alaska to monitor the temperatures and currents of water flowing from the Pacific into the Arctic. They say the average temperature of summer seawater was 0.36 degrees Celsius in the first 5 years of their study, but the average rose to 1.82 degrees in the 5 years through 2019. This translates into a 50% increase in the heat transported by seawater per second. The team says when warmer seawater melts ice, it causes the sea to absorb more sunshine. That leads to even higher sea temperatures and more melting of ice. The size of Arctic ice has been shrinking since satellite monitoring began in 1979. Scientists say ice on the Pacific side is disappearing particularly fast.
A Hong Kong conglomerate says it has stopped all operations at 2 ports along the Panama Canal after they were seized by the Panamanian government. The ports are on the Pacific side and the Atlantic side. They have been operated by a subsidiary of Hong Kong-based C.K. Hutchinson Holdings since 1997. The contract for the port operation was renewed in 2021. But Panama's Supreme Court ruled last month that the contract was unconstitutional. C.K. Hutchinson has announced that Panamanian authorities entered the terminals at the 2 ports on Monday without prior notice and took over their administration and operational control. C.K. Hutchinson calls the series of measures unlawful and says it will take further legal action in addition to the arbitration proceedings it had initiated against Panama. The development comes amid repeated remarks by President Trump that the U.S. should take back the canal from Chinese influence. C.K. Hutchinson had initially reached a basic agreement to sell the port business to a consortium led by a U.S. firm, only to be pressured by Beijing to review the deal.
The leaders of China and Germany have pledged to strengthen economic cooperation and other ties between their countries. Xi Jinping and Friedrich Merz held talks in Beijing on Wednesday.
I am willing to work together with the Chancellor to continue advancing the comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Germany to new heights.
Xi also called for cooperation in artificial intelligence and other cutting-edge technologies. Meretz expressed a desire to deepen ties with China.
We want to continue an open dialogue with mutual respect. We wish to emphasize the things we have in common and face the challenges we stand before together.
The two sides issued a joint statement after the talks. It says they'll boost economic cooperation as well as adhere to the principles of multilateralism and free trade. European leaders, including from France and Britain, have visited China in recent months. This comes as U.S. President Donald Trump pursues his America First policy.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be found at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. And all the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. An interview with Vanessa Voss of the University of Bundeswehr in Munich. Anthropic is an artificial intelligence American company with a huge Department of Defense contract. The Pentagon insists that they should continue to use the artificial intelligence for surveillance and autonomous weapons, as they did in the kidnapping of President Maduro in Venezuela. Anthropic is refusing to allow it. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
AI company Anthropic is getting under pressure from the Pentagon. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has given the AI company an ultimatum until Friday to agree to give the military full access to the company's AI models or face cuts of up to $200 million in government contracts. Hegseth reportedly demanded the AI company drop its safeguards. Anthropic, a breakaway from OpenAI, has restricted military use of its models. That includes autonomous lethal targeting and surveillance. The Pentagon is considering invoking the Defense Production Act, which could force Anthropic to allow unrestricted military use on national security grounds. Let's bring in Vanessa Voss, who's a researcher at the Bundeswehr University in Munich. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. The Pentagon wants to use AI for what it's calling, quote, all lawful purposes. From a defense perspective, what does that or could that actually mean in practice?
So it seems like the Pentagon wants to go beyond the actually agreed terms from last year, which was set not to use autonomous weapon systems without human control. So basically, it seems that now it wants to use those technologies that go beyond ISR purposes. So not only for intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance purposes, but also kinetic uses. So maybe this could lead to selecting and engaging targets with drones across all military domains and eventually having no human operator to control that. However, it is longstanding U.S. policy to only use autonomy weapon systems with, quote, appropriate levels of human judgment. Therefore, we should not expect like Terminator scenarios where machines are fighting machines, but certainly to enhance those technologies going more towards the kinetic end.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the military use of artificial intelligence for battlefield applications? You know, you've mentioned there, we're talking about spanning autonomous drone swarms, robots, cyber attacks, for example. You know, what are the big concerns here and why does Anthropic have these safeguards in particular?
Sure. So basically, when we talk about military purposes, we obviously want the armed forces to control their own technologies and their own systems. When it comes to AI, they might sort of develop a life that goes beyond what was programmed and what was intended. Therefore, we have longstanding international discussions on regulations. There's no international treaty yet, But we certainly want to make sure that we have appropriate human control. Therefore, we don't want the machine to decide and select on targets, but we still want the military to do so. And that's what is being discussed here, and which is developing not only in democratic states, but also in autocracies, of course.
We're hearing that the Pentagon is negotiating with other large language models. And through that lens, I'd like to ask you, because, I mean, Anthropic, it is holding firm right now to its red lines around autonomous weapons and mass surveillance. How do other major AI companies, and I'm thinking about Google, OpenAI, xAI, what is their position on military use cases in comparison?
So the DoD signed contracts with all these companies last year in summer, where they also agreed on certain red lines, as we mentioned before. However, now there seems to be a new development. But so far, only Anthropic is being threatened with being listed as a supply chain risk, and the others are not. So this seems to lead to the conclusion that only Anthropic is really focusing on these safeguards. And that makes sense, because in the early days of Anthropic, they were actually breaking away from OpenAI in order to put a bigger focus on safeguarding safety, reliability. Therefore, it seems that Anthropic is leading in this regard. And this is important for the DoD, because so far, this is actually the only company that has been included in classified US materials, and the others are not. So there is a big competition between those companies going on.
You know, the Pentagon is pushing this issue very aggressively. They've set this deadline now on Friday. And I'd like to ask you, what do you think happens after that deadline expires? And what are you thinking, you know, as an expert in this space, looking at what is unfolding right here?
So in order to understand Anthropic, we need to understand that this idea of safety and reliability was really the founding principle of the company. So personally, I don't think that they can actually go beyond those self-set red lines. Therefore, I think that they need to have certainly more discussions and will not directly follow this pressure by the DoD.
Vanessa Wolfs with the Bundeswehr University in Munich.
That interview is from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. And they're also available at most podcast sites. Next, France 24. An interview with Jody Ginsburg from the Committee to Protect Journalists. The CPJ has just released a report on the widespread use of torture on Palestinian journalists in Israeli prisons. The report is entitled, We Return from Hell. France 24.
What happens when journalists are punished for simply doing their job? A new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists has revealed the widespread abuse of Palestinian journalists in Israeli prisons between October 2023 and January 2026. Of 59 interviewed, nearly all reported beatings, starvation, medical negligence, sexual violence, and sensory torture. Most were held without charge under Israel's administrative detention system, often denied lawyers or proper legal support. Journalists described losing weight, injuries left untreated, confinement in loud disco rooms, and threats for their reporting. Even as we speak, at least 30 Palestinian journalists remain in custody, according to this report. For more, we're joined by the CPJ's Jody Ginsburg from New York. Jody, thank you so much. Your organization has just released this report. It's called We Return from Hell, Palestinian Journalists Recounting Torture in Israeli Prisons. Just speak to me about the general theme and what these journalists have been through.
Well, our team of researchers spoke to 59 journalists who'd been released from Israeli jails since October the 7th. And in 58 instances, 58 of the 59 reported some kind of abuse, everything from rape to sensory torture, being subjected to loud music, being forced to lie for long periods of time face down, often in filthy conditions, medical negligence. One journalist talks about receiving what's called the grand welcome, a coordinated beating of detainees when they arrive in Israeli prisons. He describes being shackled, blindfolded, and forced through a corridor of soldiers who beat him with batons and kicks. We've also heard stories of individuals being subjected to what is described as ghost hanging, having their hands tied behind their backs and then their bodies hauled and held upward.
Is this isolated event? I mean, if we're talking about Israeli officers doing this to these prisoners, these journalists, or do you believe that this is a huge systemic problem within the Israeli prison system and Israel at large?
This is absolutely not an isolated event. So this was across a number of detention centers and jails. These journalists were all spoken to individually, and they all offer separate testimonies that points to a clear pattern of systemic abuse.
In terms of the Israeli government response and the authorities there, I'm sure you've reached out to them. Has any response been forthcoming?
Well, we did reach out, and the government has refused to provide any details of any individual cases, but it has, of course, denied that it's engaging in any kind of torture. Remember, of course, that Israel is a signatory to the UN Convention Against Torture, denies that it's any of this abuse is taking place. And it has suggested, of course, that there's recourse through appeal systems. But what a number of prisoners have said, not just the journalists we spoke to, is that using these kinds of appeal and complaint mechanisms often results in worse treatment for the individuals who are being mistreated in jails.
Israel has in the past, when journalists have come under Israeli fire, they've said that they were in collaboration with forces like Hamas, like other anti-Israeli Palestinian factions. What kind of response would you give to that, you know, to actually prove that these journalists were in fact doing their jobs?
Well, the smear that we've heard repeatedly against Palestinian journalists is that they are in some way military combatants. And to date, Israel has produced no credible evidence to show that any of the individuals that it has targeted, certainly none of those that it has killed as such, are indeed active combatants. And we know from the testimonies for the people that we spoke to for this report that a number of them were specifically being targeted for their journalism. They were told not to report when they left. Their families were threatened, and they were also asked to spy effectively, some of them, on their own people for fear of not being subjected to further treatment. So these people are not being targeted simply just because they're Palestinians. They're also being targeted as journalists, because this is, of course, part of a broader pattern that we've seen in Israel of trying to control the narrative and censor information about what is happening in Gaza.
And even as we speak, 30 of those journalists are still in Israeli prisons.
They are. And one of the patterns that we've also seen is the vast majority of individuals are not charged with any crime, and that can be continued indefinitely. Many of the people that we spoke to who had been released hadn't had any access to legal representation, which again is something to which people have a right under international humanitarian law. And all of these are things that we need the international community to do much more about and speak much more forcefully about, because Israel continues to stress that it is a democracy and it is a supporter of human rights. But the evidence paints a very different picture. Well, we continue to look for mechanisms for accountability. Of course, the International Criminal Court has had a number of cases brought to it in terms of abuses that we've seen since October the 7th from Israel. We continue to look for other mechanisms where we can hold Israel to account. And one of the most important things, of course, is to continue to document and bear witness, because the documentation is key. It is key for achieving justice, even if that justice and accountability may take several years, if not decades.
Jody Ginsberg, as always, thank you so much for joining us here on France 24. And that's after that report by the CPJ. We return from Hull.
That interview was from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this show, like a longtime supporter in Dublin, Ireland did this week, my PayPal contact information is available at my website outfarpress.com or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm truly grateful for the donations. They're essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations across the globe. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The U.S. government continues to enforce an executive order imposing sanctions and tariffs on any country attempting to help Cubans get oil supplies. The kidnapped Venezuelan president and first lady have had a second court hearing in New York delayed until March 26th. In the U.K., 12 activists with Palestine Action have been released on bail from prison after several months, and 6 were found not guilty of aggravated burglary. A Palestinian-American citizen, Nasrallah Abu Siam, was killed by Israeli settlers stealing sheep in the occupied West Bank. The U.S. military destroyed another 3 people on a boat in the Caribbean, alleging them to be transporting drugs, bringing the death toll to 150. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Currently, the U.S. government is enforcing an executive order that imposes sanctions and tariffs on third countries, including regional trading partners like Mexico and Brazil, that facilitate oil supplies to Cuba, a measure that the international analysts describe as an intensification of the financial blockade. The implementation of these restrictions has led several shipping companies to reroute their ships to avoid Washington's penalties, significantly reducing the arrival of tankers at Cuban ports. This situation has resulted in the Caribbean nation operating with critically low fuel inventories, directly impacted with the electricity generation and national transportation. A federal court in New York has rescheduled the second hearing for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, First Lady and Deputy Celia Flores, for March 26th, following an agreement between the prosecution and the defense. The legitimate constitutional president of Venezuela and Celia Flores have been kidnapped since the U.S. military aggression against Venezuela on January the 3rd, which left more than 100 people dead, including 32 Cubans, and caused significant material damage. The date change, originally scheduled for March the 17th, was authorized by Judge Alvin K. Herrstein due to planning and logistical issues, according to an official statement. The head of state of Venezuela and his wife must appear before the federal court for the Southern District of Manhattan, where the judge is expected to set the schedule for proceedings and rule on pretrial motions. The initial appearance before that court was held on January the 5th, just 2 days after U.S. forces forcibly kidnapped the Venezuelan president in Caracas. On that occasion, the Bolivian president pleaded not guilty to the charges, rejected the accusations, and said he was a prisoner of war and the legitimate head of the Venezuelan state. The United States has filed charges that include alleged drug trafficking and arms trafficking, accusations that Venezuelan authorities denounce as unfounded and part of a campaign to justify intervention against Venezuela. Caracas has questioned that legality, recalling that the original indictment against Maduro for leading the so-called Cartel of the Soles was dropped for lack of concrete evidence. It was later revealed that the Cartel de los Soles is an invention by the CIA and would never exist. The case comes amid a long history of hostility between Washington and Caracas, in which the White House has frequently resorted to characterizing threats to its national security to exert political pressure or intervene directly militarily. The stance has historically served as a pretext for violating the sovereignty of nations, interfering in their internal affairs, or accessing the natural resources through sanctions, military operations, or economic pressure. The kidnapping of a sitting president and his transfer to a foreign court constitutes a flagrant violation of international law, which undermines the principles of sovereignty and non-interference in the internal affairs of other states. Furthermore, it has come to light that President Maduro and Celia Flores had a consular visit with a representative of Venezuela. In a communication, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York informed the judge that on January the 30th, the two held a consular visit with an official representing the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. The document says that the court is complying with orders issued by the arrangement and that he has instructed, the judge has instructed, the U.S. government to facilitate the defendant's access to consular services and to inform the court that once these consular services are happening, that they have taken place. The communication is signed by federal prosecutor Jay Clinton and his deputies, confirms that the Venezuelan state has been able to exercise its right of consular protection over the constitutional president of Venezuela and the First Lady, kidnapped on January the 3rd. In Britain, at least 12 activists with Palestine Action have reunited with their families after months in jail. Among the group released on bail were four hunger strikers. Only one of the 18 activists was not granted conditional bail. Their trial is scheduled for April, according to the BBC. Earlier this month, six Palestine Action protesters were found not guilty of aggravated burglary, even after they admitted to breaking into a factory operated by Israeli defense firm Elbit. The British government has banned Palestine Action under its Terrorism Act over direct action protests against Israel's war of aggression, war of genocide on Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, calls for justice are growing following the death of 19-year-old Palestinian-American Nasrallah Mohammed Hamal Abu, who succumbed to his injuries last week after he was shot by an Israeli settler. The teen was fired on when he tried to stop Israeli settlers from raiding his village to steal sheep. The family has demanded accountability from the U.S. government, with the State Department releasing a statement this weekend that had said that it expects a full, thorough, and transparent investigation. The Trump administration last year lifted sanctions on Israeli settlers, illegal settlers in the occupied territories that have been involved in violence against Palestinians for many, many years. Abu Saim was born in Philadelphia. He is at least the 11th U.S. citizen killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in the past 2 years. The United States military has blown up another boat in the Caribbean, killing at least three people. The U.S. Southern Command published a 20-second video clip of the strike on Monday, showing a small boat suddenly exploding. Donald Trump's officials again provided absolutely no evidence that the boat or the people on the boat were allegedly involved in drug trafficking. This is at least the third such attack over the course of 1 week, bringing the death toll from U.S. boat strikes in the Caribbean and Pacific to an estimated 150 people. Several legal and human rights experts have said that the attacks amount to extrajudicial killings.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show, that's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. In April, the Shortwave Report will be celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.